The Roman Catholic Diocese of Helena is at odds with an order of nuns over who should potentially pay for child sex abuse claims. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us about efforts to save an access point to Flathead Lake. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a human rights expert on an ethnic group in China fighting persecution. An order of nuns being sued for child sex abuse wants to bring the Roman Catholic Diocese of Helena back into state court. Attorneys for the Ursuline Sisters of the Western Province say they may seek to have the diocese to pay for part of any judgment that goes against the order. They want a judge to lift a stay in legal proceedings against the diocese granted when it filed for federal bankruptcy protection. The Ursulines and the diocese are being sued by 362 alleged abuse victims from the 1940s to the 1970s. The bankruptcy is part of a proposed settlement with the victims. The Ursulines are not part of the settlement. The diocese opposes the Ursulines' request. Attorney Ford Elsasser said today the settlement will take care of all claims against the diocese.
And in other news from around the state, the community rallies against the potential to lose an access to Flathead Lake. The access in question is a county right-of-way running through government and private land on the north shore of the lake. Katrin Fry reports a special state law applies when this type of access gets people to water.
This time of year, the water level on Flathead Lake is low and just starting to rise up to full pool. Near Big Fork, there's a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service waterfowl production area and a state Fish, Wildlife and Parks fisheries conservation area, both currently closed to the public. The waterfowl production area stays closed to public access from March into July while birds are nesting. Big Fork resident Dave Haddon lives near a county right-of-way access next to the production area.
The North Shore Flathead Lake is... Let me see if I can describe this. It's beautiful. The access is about a quarter mile long, and we walked due south from Holt Drive to the lake shore. And at this time of year, the lake is drawn down, and there's an expansive beach that goes east and west. This access provides year-round access to the public to the North Shore Flathead Lake.
Haddon says the key point is that this offers year-round access, while the state and federal wildlife lands have big chunks of time when they close to the public.
There's walking on the beach, there's skiing in the wintertime, snowshoeing, bird watching. The bird life here is just fantastic. And then you just have access in the summertime to shallow water where you can wade out quite a ways and swim, and people anchor their boats out here and have a good time during the summer.
There's a well-worn path heading out to the lakeshore through tall grasses and cattails. Driftwood has piled up along the shore at the end of the trail. Below the sun and water-bleached wood, the sandy mud extends out to the water off in the distance. Haddon says signs and fake cameras went up warning people off the access. A local foundation supplied the funds to resurvey the area, and now the public access point is marked by a fence and a bright pink sign. The access itself is a Flathead County road right-of-way. Public Works Director for the county, Dave Prenti, describes a right-of-way as a piece of land where the county either owns the land or has an easement on it.
For the purpose of a road or a footpath or anything like that to be utilized by the public. So it's a road right-of-way is a strip of land that is open for public travel and commerce.
County road right-of-ways are occasionally abandoned. It's a process that is usually prompted by a neighboring landowner, checked out by county staff, and decided upon by the county commissioners. However, Prunty says there's a specific state law that comes into play if the right-of-way in question provides access to water.
The county cannot abandon a right-of-way that goes to a body of water unless there is equal to or better access given in the immediate area. It can't be 3 miles down the lakeshore somewhere. It's got to be right there in the general vicinity of where the existing right-of-way is located.
Prunty notes no abandonment request has come across his desk for the North Shore access.
And the concern that a lot of people in Big Fork have is that this is very old access, and what was being discussed was not the same or equivalent access. So The public in general is really loath to give up any access, and we just wanted to get on top of this before there was any formal petition for abandonment.
Haddon says an online survey was put together for people to sign in support of this public access. He says in 24 hours, it garnered nearly 1,300 virtual signatures.
So some sandal cranes just flew in, and this is just one reason why this area is so special. You don't have to go any further than the lakeshore to just really see something pretty remarkable. And every morning I come out and I just stand right here and greet the morning, and sometimes sandhill cranes fly in, or loons fly overhead, or and there are eagles and osprey. And then the ducks are pretty magnificent. The avocets fly off the water. It's really a special place, and a lot of people, hundreds of people, come down here in the course of a week to take advantage of this public access.
Haddon says he's been talking with the nearby state and federal wildlife landowners about better access to the access site. He says the point has been made for how popular the site is. Now they need to figure out a solution to the problems with popularity, like parking. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
The Commissioner of Political Practices has dismissed a complaint accusing a Republican senator from Great Falls of coordinating his 2010 campaign with a secretive conservative group. Commissioner Jonathan Modell writes in his decision issued today that there is insufficient evidence to find Senator Ed Buttrey guilty of illegally coordinating with Western Tradition Partnership. Modell says Buttrey and Western Tradition Partnership had an arm's-length client-vendor relationship for printing services. Modell says that is a different relationship from the nine other 2010 candidates that Modell determined illegally coordinated with the group. Modell filed civil actions against those nine candidates, including Senate Majority Leader Arch Wittick of Bozeman and Representative Mike Miller of Helmville. Buttrey defeated Democrat Kathy Galvin-Helcrow in the 2010 general election. The complaint was filed this February by David Pont of Bozeman.
Cabela's has announced it will open its new outpost store in Missoula June 12th. It's the third Cabela's in Montana. An 80,000-square-foot store opened in Billings in 2009, and a 42,000-square-foot outpost store, similar to the one in Missoula, opened in Kalispell last year. Cabela's spokesman Nathan Borowski says the outpost stores are tailored to smaller markets.
They offer a seasonal product rotation and then also interactive kiosks that so you actually have access to all of Cabela's products through the kiosk and then through a site-to-store free delivery, so anything that you order will be delivered to the site free of charge. And they're just kind of a smaller, more streamlined footprint for kind of our smaller markets that help us reach markets that we maybe couldn't reach with some of our larger stores.
Borowski says Cabela's has hired 90 full-time and part-time workers for the Missoula store, which is located in the new South Crossing retail development near Brooks and Reserve Streets. He says they expect customers to come from around the region.
It's not uncommon for our customers to travel considerable distances to visit our stores. And, you know, and a lot of customers in the Missoula area have already been traveling up to our newly opened Kalispell store or even as far as Post Falls, Idaho store. So this will definitely be a store not only convenient for the local Missoula area, but also the surrounding region as well.
The new Missoula Cabela's Outpost will officially open at 11 a.m. on June 12th. The ribbon-cutting ceremony will begin at 10:45 with a Cabela's employee shooting the ribbon with a bow and arrow.
The Uyghur ethnic group in northwest China's region is increasingly making headlines in the Western press, usually in the context of a confirmed or suspected violent attack within China or Russia. A senior researcher with the Uyghur Human Rights Project is participating in the 12th Annual Central and Southwest Asia Conference underway at the University of Montana this week. Prior to joining the project in 2008, Henrik Szyjewski did his graduate work in economic, social, and cultural rights in the UK. He lived among the Uyghurs from 1994 to 1997. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Szyjewski offers us a primer on the sometimes confusing Uyghur circumstances. Take their homeland, for example. Some would point to a map and say they live in northwest China. Others would say East Turkestan.
The name is very much in dispute. I would say that East Turkestan is a sensitive term. It's used by a number of Uyghurs, many of them in exile, because the term is banned in China itself. In China, the region is known as the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region.
Tell us about this region prior to 1949.
So prior to 1949, the region was really contested by a number of interested parties. From 1933 to 1934, there was an independent republic based in Kashgar that was established by the Uyghurs. A second republic then was established in 1944 to 49. In 1949, the People's Liberation Army entered Xinjiang, and at that point, communist administration began in the region. So prior to 49, it was quite chaotic, a number of warring parties, warlords and the like. And then after 49, the communists consolidated stability in the region.
What was behind the chaos?
Well, I would say that it was a time when the Chinese Republicans were in charge, and they had a number of issues in eastern China with the Kuomintang, had issues with the communists. A civil war was in place in the east, so the West really was off their agenda, and fiefdoms were established among local warlords in the area.
A lucrative region. It sat right along the Silk Road, bridged mainland China to Arabic, Persian, European cultures.
Yes, it certainly is a lucrative region. On the one hand, it has quite substantial oil reserves, 2.5 billion tons, and also natural gas, up to 700 billion cubic meters. Also, it acts as a conduit to the markets of Central Asia, South Asia too. So the Chinese government uses the region to access the natural resources in Central Asia through Xinjiang.
And from your perspective, Dr. Zajewski, what is happening there right now? How is China treating this region?
There are a number of restrictions in place, and they focus on a number of aspects of Uyghur life. Freedom of expression is curbed, religious expression too, and also the language as well has also been targeted, in that now Uyghur children only learn Mandarin at school. So there is a number of ways in which the Chinese government policies have restricted life among Uyghurs. However, the Chinese government view it as a development issue, bringing Uyghurs into what they believe the 21st century and their version of modernity and development. The Uyghurs themselves feel like they haven't had much say in what that should look like.
Nuclear testing going on there as well, yes?
That ceased in the mid-90s, and I think I was there for one of the last ones. So the skies darkened, and somebody told me it was a sandstorm, and then other people said it was certainly not a sandstorm. But there were, I believe, over 40 tests, atmospheric and also underground. As a result, there have been some health issues in the area.
And the PLA houses Chinese soldiers a lot there? That's what I've read. I don't know if that's...
They do, yeah. There has been a spike in the number of People's Liberation Army troops in the region, especially since security has now become a priority in the area. There's also another very interesting aspect to a sort of paramilitary organization called the Bingtuan, which is established in Xinjiang, and it was established for consolidation of the state in the region, it being very far away from Beijing. And those people who work on the Bingtuan are also sometimes called in when security issues are a priority.
From what I'm hearing from you, just this basic information, I can't help but to draw a comparison to Tibet. Is that a reasonable comparison?
Absolutely. And many Uyghurs like to say that they're the Tibetans that you've never heard of.
Tell us about the people themselves. They're a Muslim people, is that correct?
That's correct.
More on the fundamentalist side or more of a secular strain, I guess?
There are a range of people practicing Islam among the Uyghurs. In general, it's a moderate version of Islam, and I think that goes for the Central Asian region in general. The Islam is Sufi-infused, but also it has some traces of pre-Islamic traditions too. So I would characterize it as a moderate version of Islam.
When you say Sufi-infused, what does that mean?
It means that there's worship of saints, and also many Uyghurs go to pilgrimage sites and leave tokens there, asking for saints to grant wishes. But also there's a mystical strain to their religion too. on one occasion in Kashgar when I was there, there were in front of the mosque on one of the festival days, many of the Uyghurs spin themselves into a trance in order to become closer to God. I remember my first visit to Xinjiang. I guess I termed it as assault by hospitality. Wherever I went, I was offered food and the people very, very generous, but also with a lot of intellectual capacity and deep thinkers about their condition and looking for ways to improve that in the future.
Uyghurs are a relatively new player when it comes to Westerners, I think. That's my assumption, mm-hmm. Americans. And when we do hear about them in the American news media, it's always in relation to, again, my perspective, some form of violence. Mm. A mass knife attack in a faraway rail station. A fatal car attack in Tiananmen Square. Theories of Uyghur involvement in Flight 370's disappearance. I guess, number one, is my characterization correct? And what do you think of Western news coverage of the Uyghurs?
It's unfortunate that the focus has been on violent incidents. Now, I cannot deny that there have been violent incidents. Last year, from my own research, just in 2013 alone, 219 people were killed in 25 separate incidents in Xinjiang alone. So, yes, there has been a spike in violence, but that is not the entire story. There is a story of peaceful dissent. There is a story of people also trying to negotiate an identity for themselves in the 21st century. So my characterization would be, of course, that the media certainly would like to focus on those particular violent incidents because they are headline grabbing in many ways, whilst the slow progression of human rights advocacy, for example, is certainly something that doesn't capture the eye easily.
You said that many are trying to negotiate an identity for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Negotiate what and how?
Well, because the Chinese state has tried to influence the Uyghurs to come join modern China, and in many ways that has been through asking young Uyghurs to learn Chinese as their main medium, the language that they should speak in everyday life. So I think that those Uyghurs are trying to balance up their Uyghurness and then this new part of this new identity that's being offered by the Chinese state. So a lot of them are trying to fuse the two and see how that will work for them in the future. It's a careful balancing act. On the one hand, they do need Mandarin skills in order to be successful in the job market, but they also don't want to lose their cultural identity at the same time. So at the moment, there's an interesting negotiation between many young Uyghurs about how to move forward with those two identities.
Odds are against them. They're so outnumbered.
Indeed. However, I would add that there's hope. I think that many Uyghurs strongly identify as Uyghurs. It's a way to show separateness from Han Chinese, for example. And also, it's something that is a pride that is handed down from generation to generation. A recent survey, for example, stated that 90% of Uyghurs were proud to be Uyghurs as compared to perhaps 66% of Han Chinese. And that shows me that there's strength for the future.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is earning a reputation, I think, as a man of, he's a tough guy. How would you characterize his treatment of that region, that disputed autonomous region?
We were very hopeful at first when Xi Jinping was to assume the presidency. He talked about reform. However, some of those promises have not been kept. Specifically, earlier this year, he discussed how he would de-emphasize development policies in Xinjiang and emphasize security in the region. And that meant a crackdown not just on violent dissenters, but peaceful dissenters too. So that's of concern.
And Vladimir Putin?
Vladimir Putin, that's a great question, because I think that what he is up to in the Ukraine is something that the Chinese are keeping an eye on, because it's about sovereignty issues, and China is extraordinarily sensitive about sovereignty regarding Tibet, Xinjiang, Mongolia, Taiwan, and also the South China Sea too. So at this point, it's a wait-and-see game for the Chinese.
Mm. Also joining us today is Dr. Mehrdad Kia, director of the University of Montana Central and Southwest Asian Study Center. Nice to see you again.
Nice.
Tell us about the conference underway that brought Dr. Sijevsky to us.
Thank you, Ed. This is, as you know, the 12th annual Central and Southwest Asia Conference. We are extremely happy that we have managed to hold this conference with a large number of scholars, analysts, diplomats, writers, journalists coming to University of Montana for the last 12 years. This year, we are very excited. We have an outstanding speaker who will speak about China, Western China, and Chinese policy in a very critical region of the world, which is only coming to the attention of the American public recently. But this has been a historical area of conflict, Central Asia and next to it, Western China. But we also have an excellent presentation tomorrow night on the question of the Arab Spring, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, with Dr. Shukri Abed, who comes directly from Jerusalem. And then during 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we have a number of wonderful panels and panelists that are coming from all over. It might be of some interest that tomorrow we will have a presentation by a Uyghur artist, in fact, Nejat Hushur, who comes from Xinjiang, and he will talk about arts and cultures of the Uyghur people.
I don't mean to spring this on you. Forgive me if if it's a surprise. You mentioned the Arab Spring. Uh-huh. What's your take on it right now? The Arab Fall, the Arab Winter?
You know that I think when we last talked, I mentioned that it was quite rainy and cold in the Arab world, and the results have not been the Jeffersonian democracy that some had predicted. I think with the sole exception of Tunisia, you may conclude that the Arab Spring has moved toward a very cold winter. And the situation in Egypt with the rise of a new military dictator, the Syrian civil war ongoing and becoming even more violent, the unsettling situation in Iraq itself, all of this makes you very pessimistic. But, you know, history moves forward. The Arab people showed that there is at least an educated, moderate, middle class in the Arab world, as you saw in the case of Tunisia and Egypt and earlier in Syria, who are demanding democracy, human rights, a more transparent and less corrupt government. And those folks are still around. So it is not over. As a country, we have gone through some major struggles to get where we are. And I think the Arab world has awakened to the need for change. But how this change will come about will be very interesting to see.
Henrik, you're nodding your head in agreement.
Absolutely, yes. I think that this is something that seems very critical to China, too, and how democratic reforms will play out in the future.
The 12th Annual Central and Southwest Asia Conference at the University of Montana. Professor Kia, how can people find out more? Is there a clearinghouse of information?
Yes, we are on the main UM website, so the schedule is there, as well as, of course, on Central Southwest Asian Studies Center website, cswa.umt.edu. And we look forward to having everyone, and it's open to public and it's free.
And Henrik Sijewski, you are not new to Missoula, as it turns out.
Absolutely, that's right. I got married here. My wife grew up in Missoula, and this University of Montana is her alma mater. So I'm very, very happy to be back.
Excellent to have you here. It is a very small world, as we were saying earlier. Thank you both for coming in. It was great talking.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, rain showers are likely with a chance of snow and lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow, rain showers are likely still with a chance of snow. High should be in the 40s. In central Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect from midnight tonight to 6 p.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front, as well as Eastern Glacier, Toole, and Eastern Pend'Oreille counties. There's also a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 10 tonight for Maher County. Tonight, expect rain showers and thunderstorms with lows 35 to 40 degrees and wind gusts up to 45 miles per hour, increasing to 65 miles per hour overnight. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow and highs 45 to 55 degrees. Expect wind gusts up to 50 miles per hour. In southwest Montana, there's a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 10 this evening for Beaverhead, Madison, Broadwater, and Gallatin counties. Tonight, expect thunderstorms with rain and snow showers. Lows should be 25 to 35 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 45 miles per hour, increasing to 55 miles per hour overnight. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the 40s. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. It's been a long, cold, wet winter, and here in Missoula it's been gray since November. Seasonal affective disorder, SAD, is everywhere, and vitamin D is in short supply. In fact, I've been referring to this winter as my second winter of discontent. Now, I focus on winter blahs today because I recently read an article that talked about the strong correlation between SAD and serious depression. Now, there's no doubt that depression is a strong influence in the incidence of suicide, and, as we all know, suicide among the veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars is at what could be called epidemic proportions, just as it was for Vietnam vets. Now, I have continuing reservations about any program being properly handled by either the VA or the Department of Defense, DOD, especially when such programs are to address new or uncomfortable issues or use new or untried methods. And that's definitely my attitude when the program is to address issues in which compassion or the human equation is its focus. Well, true to my cynical projections, the DOD is, I'm told, cutting funding for what's known as the Yellow Ribbon Program. Now, in case you haven't heard of the Yellow Ribbon Program, it's an effort developed initially by the Montana and Minnesota National Guards and adopted by DOD to provide readjustment help for Iraq and Afghan war soldiers immediately upon their return from war. My understanding is that the troops spend 3 or 4 days, once back in America, being acquainted with war trauma counseling, financial, spiritual, educational, and similar needs services. Training and counseling for suicide prevention are a central part of this retreat. The primary purpose of Yellow Ribbon is not only to help these new veterans find their place in civilian society, but more basic, to help reduce the upward spiraling suicide rate among this latest generation of veterans. Admittedly, I have been more than a little skeptical about how successful a program can be when it's premised on curing the symptoms rather than the cause of an illness. Multiple deployments and superficial support for our soldiers that was not matched by sufficient material support for them or the families they left behind have caused problems in the Iraq-Afghan veteran community. A few days of counseling cannot possibly alleviate those problems, but that never seemed to be a reality that DOD, the VA, or for that matter our government or citizenry wanted to address. Not only that, in my mind, while the seeds of PTSD are planted in war itself, that problem does not germinate until some time has passed. In other words, I believe it's a veteran problem, not a soldier's issue. Therefore, as I see it, PTSD cannot be treated fully in the 4 days immediately following a soldier's return from war. That treatment must be available to the veteran in the months or years after his or her guns of war have fallen silent. But even if the Yellow Ribbon Program was not the alpha and omega for addressing these young soldiers' issues, primarily suicide, it was at least an effort, and sometimes just knowing an effort is being made to help can itself be part of the cure. And yet, because the Iraq War has ended and the Afghan War is winding down, DOD is decreasing funding almost to nothingness for its Yellow Ribbon Program. In their thinking, I guess it's not needed anymore. Needless to say, in spite of rhetoric inferring otherwise, the VA shows no heart for transferring the Yellow Ribbon Program or its equivalent to their auspices, at least not in any substantive way. No picking up on suicide prevention training or even finding a way to involve veteran service groups in that task. So now these newest of America's veterans will be left to face the psychological ghosts of war at the most vulnerable of times, with little assurance that the government that sent them to war is committed to helping them deal with that war's demons. To a Vietnam veteran, that sounds sickeningly familiar. And maybe worst of all, America's citizenry, which supposedly showed its love of its Iraq-Afghan soldiers by putting plastic magnetic yellow ribbons on their SUVs, seems as unconcerned about the happenings now that the war is off of the front page as it was with the Vietnam veterans' plight once Saigon fell. I was right when years ago I predicted that for far too many of this group of veterans, the yellow ribbons would turn into red tape. It's just that it's happening quicker than I thought it would. History seems to be repeating itself. If anyone thought it would be different this time around, well, I guess they're mistaken. And if I can offer any advice to my younger veteran comrades, it would be this. Don't expect or wait for the government, the media, or the American public to argue your case and make things happen for you. Do it yourself. Organize. Speak out. Grab hold of the issues important to you, and don't let go. This is Dan Gallagher with the Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our website at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.